Right, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Lovely to see such a full hall. I should introduce myself. I'm Gus O'Donnell. I was the Cabinet Secretary and Head of the Civil Service under Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, and David Cameron, and basically spent my life doing economic policy advice based on the works of economists, many of them in this room today. So thank you for all of that. Tonight we're here for the Lionel Robbins lecture. These are a series of lectures that have been going on for a number of years. There will be three. Today is the first of three, so Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Lionel Robbins himself was associated with LSE for about 30 years. He wrote in 1932 The Nature and Significance of Economic Science, which is something we'll be talking about tonight. He went on to be, as all good economists should, involved in real public policy work as the director of the economic section of the War Cabinet during the Second World War. A great quote from the Nature and Significance work, economists deal with ascertainable facts, ethics with valuations and obligations. The two fields of inquiry are not on the same plane of discourse. So he had a very strong view that economics wasn't about moral judgments. And then there's this economist, which I'll let you guess, who came up with it, a rather different view. And I quote, "As against Robbins, economics is essentially a moral science. That is to say, it employs introspection and judgment of value." Now, that was an economist who combined academic work with helping governments and the Treasury in particular, a chap called John Maynard Keynes. You may have heard of him. Then when we come to the 75th anniversary conference here at the LSE on that nature and significance work back in 2007, Tony Atkinson, the late, great Tony Atkinson, and I quote from him on that a paper he gave at that conference, "Economics is not only a moral but also a very relevant science." And Tony Atkinson was someone who also spent a lot of his time working on real, practical policy issues. So, if we had Keynes, Robbins, and Atkinson in the room tonight, they would all be delighted about the subject matter, what we're talking about tonight, very close to their hearts. Our lecturer tonight is Jeff Sachs, who's a professor at Columbia, director of the Earth Institute, and this isn't the first time he's done this lecture. Back in 1991, he was here giving the Robbins lecture on market reforms in Poland. Indeed, he was there at the heart of the transitions in Central and Eastern Europe and Russia, also advising countries like Bolivia. Spent his life working on issues of massive importance to the world economy, sustainability, climate change, development. He is the UN Secretary General's advisor on all sorts of areas, particularly climate change, and he is director of the UN Sustainable Development Solutions Network. I've been out with Jeff and Richard Lau there in the front working on their World Happiness Reports, which come out every year, Sachs, Lau, and John Helliwell from Canada. And he has emphasized in those measuring success by looking at overall well-being. So not only has Jeff done all of that, but he's written three books which have appeared on the New York Times bestseller list. And his latest work, which is entitled Building the New American Economy, Smart, Fair, and Sustainable, you can pick up outside. And then after the lecture in the Q&A, he'll be very happy to sign copies of that book. So the plan tonight is Jeff will give his lecture for around about an hour, then we'll have time for a Q&A session, and then we'll move to the book signing. So now, please welcome Jeff Sachs.
Good evening, everybody. Gus, thank you so much for being here and presiding and for that lovely introduction. And Richard Layard, a dear friend and colleague, thank you for inviting me back. I waited 26 years, but I hung in there hoping for another invitation. For those of you who weren't here in 1991, I will tell you the truth. This is my favorite place in the world to give a talk. It literally is this room, this hall, you, because also LSE is a unique institution. It's so much fun and so alive and so much part of the resonant debates in the world, which is the genius of this institution. It couldn't be more in the world and in the present and on the urgent topic, so it's really fun. But what a great place to speak also. It's just a beautiful, beautiful hall. So I'm very excited and very pleased to be talking about a topic that I think maybe at my age, at this stage of my career, you've mulled over a lot, which is what's it all about, economics, and what are the values of the profession, and how do they relate to the values of life? So this question of economics and morality is really my topic for these 3 days. You heard that Lionel Robbins, after whom these lectures are named and in whose memory these lectures are given, had a pretty strong view of this, that economics and morality don't really mix. They're two different topics. And then you heard the pushback from a contemporary and a senior in the 1930s when Robbins wrote those ideas, Keynes in Cambridge, that, of course, this is a moral science. I think they're both right in one sense, and that is Robbins is probably not so wrong in terms of how economics is actually taught and done. I don't know about students here, but our students at Columbia University have almost no moral training at all. They read, I'm not saying they're immoral, they have no training. They have no education on moral theory, on moral philosophy. They do not know the history of their own field. They don't know the history of ethical thinking, and that's what I'm going to talk about this evening. I've very meanly given them spot quizzes about such things, not my own students, but when I happen to give a lecture to first-year students. I don't know whether it's better here, but in a PhD program in economics and in the East Coast of the United States, you'd learn no moral philosophy at all. You would learn Pareto improvement, you'd learn something about compensation, but that's just about it. And in that sense, unfortunately, I think Robbins was right as a description of the field, and I don't think it's changed from his time till now in the right direction. I'm going to talk about what the field ought to be, because I think that this is perhaps the greatest weakness of economics as a field of practice and a field of knowledge. What grew up as a fairly radical divorce between economics and what I would say is serious moral reasoning and serious ethical thinking. In fact, I'm going to argue that it's not just wrong, but a disaster, and that it helps us to understand certain very deep and dark puzzles of our world. So today I'm going to speak about economics and moral science, as I'm going to call it, because I want to argue that moral thinking is a science. It's the science of human well-being, and it has a body of knowledge that has radically deepened in the last 50 years. It's a profoundly rich science, and economics should embrace that science. And that's what I'm going to try to argue tonight. Tomorrow, I'm going to talk about some hard aspects of that issue, because the idea of moral science is that we can be moral. And being moral is a good thing. In fact, I'm going to define it to mean being a good thing, that it's pro-social, that it leads to good outcomes in society, that it raises human well-being. And tomorrow night I'm going to talk about several reasons why morality is hard. You probably have some in your own mind, but I'm going to talk about some of the difficulties where our human nature really does present powerful obstacles, and where at least my argument is going to be that our self-understanding, it's an argument that goes back to Socrates after all, that our ability to understand ourselves better and understand our human nature, and I do believe there is a human nature that is shared, deep, and important for us to understand, will help us to find pathways to moral outcomes when they are not easy to achieve. And you may have noticed there are a lot of things that are not very moral or ethical in the world. It seems to be a job description for American politicians these days. We have some real displays of sociopathy that are very impressive. We'll talk a little bit about actually psychopathy tomorrow and its implications. And we'll watch for tweets tonight for relevance. And then on the third day, I want to talk about how we can use moral thinking in an economic context to address some of the unique challenges that I think are core economic challenges for us that I'm going to speak about as we open. So the last thing I need to do is to figure out where to point this there. So tonight I want to talk about economics and morality. And I guess it's there. There is Lionel Robbins, he gave a definition for economics which has still resonance today. This is from that famous essay on the nature and significance of economic science. And go home and get the PDF. It's online. It's worth reading. It's a very interesting piece from 85 years ago. So he says, economics is the science which studies human behavior as a relationship between ends and scarce means which have alternative uses. Interesting. But then when he comes to the question of ends, that's where he really punts, because one way to think about ends is in an Aristotelian sense of telos, end purposes. What are our goals? What are our reasons for doing things? That's not at all what he means by ends. What Lionel Robbins means by ends is whatever the ends happen to be. And he goes out of his way in this essay to say this: economics is neutral as between ends. Economics cannot pronounce on the validity of ultimate judgments of value. And that is this purported divorce between rational action towards ends and what those ends might be. Are those ends moral ends? Are they immoral ends? Are they any ends that might happen to occur? And Robbins is actually reflecting a deep strain of British thinking that goes back several centuries. I think it's a very bad strain of thinking, but an extremely influential one. And since Britain has been the most influential country in the world for the last three centuries, that bad thinking has permeated a lot of other thinking, including American thinking, which takes everything British and makes it dumber, then goes on to amplify it in our own ways, usually through Twitter. But that idea that we can't talk about ends are just what they are, is actually a deep idea, and I'm going to revisit where that comes from. So this is what Gus read to us. Economics deals with ascertainable facts, ethics with valuations and obligations. One is science, and the other is, well, that's what you think, because that's what a lot of economists are trained to believe about values. Well, that's what you think. My values are different. That is not moral science. That's a dumb level of discourse. And it's one that reflects the lack of training in thinking about ends, purposes, and what values might mean, because we have much more serious ways to think about values. And it's not true that we should be indifferent among ends. So, as I said, Robbins' approach remains an accurate description, I think, of where economics is, but a wholly inadequate description of what economics ought to be. I think that the weakness that comes from this approach helps us to address, and this is my argument in these lectures, three big puzzles, but I could name many more. But let me give you three puzzles that I'm going to talk about on Wednesday evening. Puzzle one, 6 million children, 6 million children this year will die under the age of 5 in low-income countries because of extreme poverty. 6 million deaths. Almost all of the causes of those deaths are either preventable or treatable diseases. I've studied this issue for 20 years. My estimate is that for 0.1 of 1% of the income of the rich world, 0.1 of 1%, something on the order of $50 billion a year out of a $50 trillion annual output of the rich world, these deaths could essentially be brought to near zero. To me, that's a puzzle. Why does the world care so little about so much suffering and the suffering so easy to address? Of course, some economists have accused me wrongly over the years of saying, oh, it's so easy. And every time I've been able to get my hands on some money, I've shown how easy it is. Malaria deaths down by about 60% in the last 12 years after a nonstop bruising battle with Bill Easterly over the years, who said, don't do that, can't give the bed nets, don't do this. Well, finally, I won that debate. The bed nets were distributed. Malaria deaths are down by about 2/3. Now there's a big puzzle in the economics profession. Why did they actually give the nets to the people who need them? That's not how it's supposed to work. They're supposed to have been stolen. Honestly, there's a paper on this topic, very puzzled, they've discovered some concept that I'm going to talk about, a pro-sociality, that the health workers didn't just steal the nets. They actually gave them to the children. Okay, but once you see it, to my mind, if we were right thinking, we'd say, what do we do to get this over? Could we go down and to the rest? The answer is simple, by the way. Every malaria case can be treated and cured. It's a 100% curable disease if you have a bite from an infected mosquito and it's caught within 24 hours. It's a matter of access of poor people to the health system. But almost nobody cares. I sit every night waiting for Donald to call me. What do we do about those malaria deaths? But what's likely to happen is that we're going to see a cut of aid. And our economics profession basically couldn't care less. Next. Human-induced climate change threatens the survival and well-being of hundreds of millions of people. Don't ask me, ask the climate scientists. I had 14 terrifying years as director of the Earth Institute. Every day, one of my climate scientists would come up to me to scare the wits out of me. It's worse than you think, Professor Sachs. We've just discovered it's more fragile, the West Antarctic ice sheet, it's doing this and that, horrible things. And, of course, that's why our State Department is now given over to ExxonMobil. I mean, literally, you can't make this stuff up. But did the economics profession respond? Nah, barely. Because even with existential issues like this, there are people interested. Lord Nick Stern has led beautifully on this topic for years. But it's a battle because we're really interested in whether the growth rate is going to be down 0.1% in the third quarter. That's what's important. That's part of this question. Third puzzle, famous one that motivates the work that Richard Layard and John Helliwell, and I'm lucky to join the experts in this. The U.S. has roughly tripled its income per capita since 1960, and yet we keep going down in self-reported happiness. And what is our goal? If you ask almost any politician or look at the questions of the debates that we had before the election and all the discussion, it's how to get growth, more growth, more growth, more growth. And most of the economics profession that works in macroeconomics, that's the focus. And yet there's really a big question. What happened to the last 55 years since roughly 1960 when we've seen no discernible evidence that this is making any of us in the United States feel better? And the evidence now is we're feeling a lot worse these days, by the way. So it's even more pertinent. So those are puzzles that, in my view, have as the partial answer this unfortunate divorce between economics and morality, or economics and ethics. Because if we were thinking more clearly, the most important point for the economics profession is we would be studying different problems. That's the most important point. We would feel that it's urgent to understand what deaths are avertible. We would think that it's urgent to think about how people's lives can be improved. We would understand that when small amounts of funding could save the earth, that that's probably a pertinent observation about economic life. So this is the sense in which I think these puzzles have as part of the answer this question about what it is we study. So I believe economic science should provide better answers and corrective approaches. But to do so requires a reformulation of economics in two fundamental senses. One is what we would call the economic anthropology. What is the model of human nature that underpins economic science? Our model is a model that was set somewhere around 1800. It got mathematized, it got locked in place, it is observed, and now there have been at least two important Nobel Prizes that say it's wrong, but it's not really reformulated in a serious way. There is behavioral economics, but I think that treats this in a somewhat trivial way, actually. Even though some of the findings are important, the idea that the implication is we should nudge people to do a little bit more of this or a little bit less of that strikes me as a wholly inadequate response to the lack of a sound anthropology, a sound human nature understanding that underpins this field. And second, there is no foundation on moral science. So those are my arguments. So what is morality? Well, most of it is the golden rule. And most of it is summarized by the golden rule in its two variants. The negative one, don't do to others what you do not want them doing to you. Or in the positive side, do unto others what you would have them do to you. It's amazing the longevity of this idea. It permeates serious moral reasoning for 2,500 years at least. And that's probably only because we don't have good documentation that extends beforehand. So there are two aspects of the Golden Rule that I'm going to talk about. One is the sense of cooperation. Don't cheat on me. Don't lie to me. Don't break your word. Kant, of course, talks about a lot of this as examples of the categorical imperative, as Kant uses the categorical imperative as his restatement of the Golden Rule. The other is redistributive justice, basically the distribution of well-being in society. These are two strands that both have the Golden Rule in some way reflecting them, and I'll talk about both of these. Well, we know now that we can talk about issues around basic cooperation effectively in all of the variants of the so-called social dilemma. A social dilemma is a circumstance where the outcomes of individual interactions pose a real problem to get to well-being. And the most famous case is the prisoner's dilemma. And this is an example in the negative variant of the prisoner's dilemma. Suppose you have two people, and each one at a cost C can cheat the other and draw resources from the other in the amount B greater than C. So you can steal from the counterpart. And you can steal an amount B greater than C. It could be a business partner you're embezzling. It could be someone that you make a contract with that you cheat. It could be someone that you lie to. But you can do damage. And if both cheat, each one steals an amount B from the other. They end up expending each an amount C. They both lose in the end. And so you have the cell in the upper left-hand corner of minus C minus C. If both are honest, nobody expends resources to steal from the counterpart. You end up at 0, 0. And of course, if person one cheats on the other and the person two is honest, the honest person loses an amount B, and the cheater, of course, gets a benefit B, that transfer in this simple example, greater than the cost of the cheating. And when you analyze the prisoner's dilemma, of course, the point is that no matter what this person does, if this person decides to cheat, better for person one also to cheat rather than to have just an amount B stolen from him. So if person two cheats, person one should cheat. If person two is honest, person two should still cheat in the narrow sense of taking B away from the counterpart, getting that benefit. So the prisoner's dilemma discovered back in 1950 showed that the dominant strategy in these circumstances, the strategy that each individual actor should follow, is to cheat or to be dishonest to the counterpart. The outcome is a mutual loss, and so you have a social dilemma in that honesty is the best policy, but it's not the dominant policy. So the individual incentive is to cheat, but the socially preferred outcome is mutual honesty. And the question is, how do you achieve cooperation? And of course, you can, in a completely different circumstance, or in the positive case, an altruist can bear a cost C to give a benefit B to the other. So altruism says, I bear a cost to give a larger benefit to my counterpart. And the socially optimum is that both sides are altruistic. But the dominant strategy is for both sides to be greedy. yes, I could be altruistic and give you something, and if you were altruistic and gave me something, we'd both be better off. But frankly, I'd like you to be altruistic. I'll be greedy, thank you. And so we end up with the classic prisoner's dilemma again. So this has helped us tremendously to understand a clarity of what morality is about. Morality in this context, in the cooperation context, is how to reach a pro-social outcome when there are dilemmas involved or tendencies or even dominant strategies for people to be antisocial. And there are thousands of papers written about this now in the last 30 years. It's one of the most important conceptual breakthroughs. But it's given a clarity to what moral behavior is about that I think was understood 2,500 years ago, but now can be put in quite clear terms, and we can understand that individual behavior is not necessarily moral. It could be. When these games are studied, cooperation is more than the game theory outcome suggests, because game theory basically says in a one-shot game of either of these variants, there should be mutual cheating, the antisocial outcome, and you get something in between cooperation and full cheating, except if it's economic students, and then they all cheat. And we don't know whether that is self-selection or trained incapacity to be human. It's probably some combination of the two. We're teaching the wrong thing. We should be studying how to cooperate, not saying that cooperation is a fool's errand, and don't be suckered. Or as our president says, there are killers and there are losers. And you kind of believe him in his madness. That's how he views the world. So we know that there are many variants of this problem, but I introduce it in this simple, formal way to say that the issue of morality can be given a very tight, clear, rigorous example in this case. We can define morality as being the pro-social outcome. And I want to define moral science as not being what you might read in the scriptures, so there's a lot of wisdom in ancient texts, or what somebody just says, but I want to define moral science as the science of human well-being. What rules are conducive? What behaviors, what patterns are conducive to pro-social outcomes? And in an end-person game, that's about public goods, that's about not wrecking the world by destroying the commons, and it's also about social insurance. How do we share risk in a society rather than individually bearing risk? So that's morality for cooperation. There's another kind of issue which in some ways is related, in other ways is different, and that's the redistributive issue. Suppose that there are two people and there's one choice. Person number two, who has a large income, who's rich, can choose to make a transfer to the poor person, who's person number one. So one outcome is that the rich person gives no transfer, and there's a level of income of person one here, very poor, very rich. Or person two makes a transfer T, maybe at some cost, because taxation could have distorting effects. There could be what Arthur Oaken, an economist in the 1960s and to 80s, called the leaky bucket, that if you make the transfer, not all of it reaches the intended recipient, certainly not through public policy. And then the question is, should that transfer be made? What is the moral case for making the transfer? And this problem, of course, has been studied also in thousands of papers now, because there's a game that's exactly this game, the dictator game. The dictator game says you have endowments and one person can choose, should I give something to the other person? For a while, it looked optimistic in the dictator game, that when people were given the option, do you make a transfer to the other to make some more fairness in an allocation, there were a lot of transfers made. Then it was discovered about 10 years ago that if instead of giving only the choice of making the transfer, you also had the choice to even take away from the poor person, then the transfer stopped because the people could be really mean, actually, and say, oh, I could steal even more from them. I'm a good guy. I won't take anything. So the tendency for redistribution was lower once there was a two-sided possibility that T could be positive or negative. But there still are examples of, in that game, of people making transfers. But what there certainly is what is akin to what John Rawls called the original position or the veil of ignorance. If people are asked, what should that transfer T be, if you don't know whether you're going to be the one with income Y1 or income Y2, then there is absolutely a desire for transfers. So if you are looking at it from an impartial point of view or an ex-ante point of view, then you could say that there is evidence of the desire for some kind of transfer, if nothing more than as a kind of social insurance. Well, morality deals with both the cases of cooperation, honesty, cheating, lying, embezzlement, pollution, external costs that are imposed, and the question of redistribution. They're both issues. This one, I think, is probably more tendentious and complex, but we'll have occasion to talk about both of them. Now, my argument is that while we've been discussing morality for as long as we suspect, as long as we've had discussions as a species, and we know at least since the axial age 2,500 years ago, or 2,700 years ago, we have had moral discussions, we should understand the pathways that those discussions have taken and the remarkable increased insights that have come in recent times. Because a lot of the speculation of the past was speculation that did not have the kind of fact base that we now have that allows us to deepen significantly our understanding of these issues. So I want to start back at the beginning. Start with Confucius. Confucius, in the Analects, says, do not impose on others what you yourself do not desire. The golden rule is the first teaching of the Analects, and it shows that the golden rule, which is pervasive in Western philosophy, is also pervasive in Eastern philosophy, and that's true of all major religions till today as well, that the golden rule remains the underpinning of moral reasoning of every major religion. But Confucius also said something that's important for us. He said, by three methods we may learn wisdom. First, by reflection, which is noblest. Second, by imitation, which is easiest. And third, by experience, which is bitterest. But the point is, in moral reasoning, it's important to understand how do moral ideas or virtues or dispositions come about. And one of the core ideas from the ancient past and now reinforced by modern science is that they come about through practice and experience as well as through education. And so these are ideas that are taught, they are learned, They are gained by habit. Buddha had another idea about all of this, an important idea, which we now call the failures of affective forecasting. Buddha's idea was, that benefit, it's not even there. You're going to steal and think you're going to feel better off? That's an illusion. And so for Buddha, the whole trapping of that game theory setup is suspect, because the question of how you view those interactions and what you view as a benefit and what you view as your preferences are grossly mismanaged. So when I come to economic thinking, we're going to say, as Lionel Robbins did, whatever people say is good, that's what's good. Buddha is almost the opposite. Buddha's idea is you better study, meditate, use every exercise to break your addictions, which will lead you to suffering. And it's only through the mind and mind practice, mind exercise, that you have a chance. So to enjoy good health, to bring true happiness to one's family, to bring peace to all, one must first discipline and control one's mind. Hold the thought. We will come back to it. Aristotle, he's my guy. I just feel part of maybe this Aristotelian tradition more than any of the others that I'll mention. But Aristotle's idea, like Buddha and Confucius, was that morality is cultivated. Morality is hard won. It's not just there or not there. It's something you work towards. And working towards it is part of working towards a valued life. So Aristotle and the Nicomachean Ethics is a guidebook of what is a life worth living. And what is a life that in Greek he called eudaimonia, we translate maybe as happiness, maybe as flourishing, maybe as thriving, but it means a life well lived. And Aristotle said a couple of things, that to live a good life is to develop virtues. Virtues are dispositions to behave well. These virtues are formed in man by his doing the actions, learning by doing. The good of man is a working of the soul in the way of excellence in a complete life. Again, it's an achievement to live well. It's an achievement to be moral. It's something to work on. Buddha, in a different way. Confucius, also about cultivation of good behavior. And then Aristotle, in one of the famous chapters of the Ethics, talks about friendship, because, of course, Aristotle in the opening pages of the Politics says man is a social animal. Politics is about living in society. Being virtuous is about behaving in society. I want you to hold that thought, too, because it goes away, strangely enough, in economics. But the idea that friendship is one of the supreme values that makes life worth living, and that that has implications for economics, is incredibly important. So, Hillel, one of the great Jewish teachers in the first century AD, in a famous story in the Talmud, was provoked by a provocateur who said to Hillel, I will convert to Judaism if you can teach me the Torah, that is the Jewish book of laws, while I stand on one foot. And Hillel, without hesitating, said, that which is despicable to you, do not do to your fellow. That is the whole Torah. The rest is commentary. Go and learn it. Supposedly the man put his other foot down and converted to Judaism. But you see, the whole of Torah, that's all of the law received by Moses on Mount Sinai in the Jewish tradition, is summarized by the golden rule. Don't be a nuisance to other people if you don't want them to do the same to you. As my mother would have said, be a mensch. That's also the Jewish teaching on one foot, which is behave and do the same as you would want others to do. Don't bother them. Jesus, the same, of course, in the gospel. So whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for that is the law and the prophets. Of course, Jesus was a Jewish teacher and teaching the Jewish law. I heard a bishop recently summarize Christian social ethics in three sentences, essentially, or in three ways that I thought was very persuasive. One is the golden rule. The second is Matthew 25. In the day of judgment, the king will reply, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me." Social justice, Matthew 25. And the third is, of course, the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. And blessed are the meek, and blessed are the poor. Now we get to Britain. First problem, Thomas Hobbes. Hobbes, all of these theories that we've quickly toured are theories of human nature. The religious ones as well, because the human nature in the Jewish or the Christian scriptures is that man is created in God's image. For Aristotle, man is a social animal. Brilliant insight, not theistic. For Confucius, social harmony is at the core. For Hobbes, remarkably, in the founding document of Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-American political theory, society is not the starting point. Solitary man is the starting point. The initial condition is not a social order. It's not a social animal. It is a solitary life. And the solitary life is a war of all against all. And it is, in fact, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. I find this fascinating. This is not meant to be a thought experiment. This is meant to be an analytical treatment of human beings and human nature. And so it's a claim. It's a scientific claim, not with the evidence to back it up. But it's actually, and Hobbes was directly meaning to attack Aristotle because he was in a phase where the scholastic teachings of Aristotle were under attack for good reason in physics, but he used this to attack Aristotelian social teachings as well. And so for Hobbes, man is not a social animal. Man is a solitary animal who will kill other human beings except if there is a Leviathan, an all-powerful sovereign put over them. And basically, Hobbes, in a way, invented the prisoner's dilemma in political theory by saying people will do the antisocial thing unless someone forces them into the good cell. And from there came Locke, Hume, the social contract theory, the idea that we need to invent a social structure, because otherwise we'll kill each other. That, I want to emphasize, is meant to be an empirical theory. not a thought experiment on a problem set. It's wrong as far as we can tell, because there are not societies, as most we can understand of societies that would come closest to Paleolithic societies. They're not war of all against all. All of the evidence is that humanity has lived in groups from the birth of our species, probably for before Homo sapiens, but in hominid, at least going back to Neanderthal and around 500,000 years ago at least, and probably because of the gains of cooperation from hunting, even 2 million years of social evolution. But Hobbes then took the lesson, for the laws of nature, as justice, equity, modesty, mercy, and in some doing to others as we would be done to, in other words, the golden rule, of themselves without the terror of some power to cause them to be observed, are contrary to our natural passions. This is really important, because the theory here is you cannot get a moral outcome without a Leviathan. And that, by the way, is what we teach in economics till today. I think Hobbes's influence is profound, because there's a clear line of thinking that deviates sharply from all the thinkers that we just saw. Mandeville famously added an even more counterintuitive proposition. He invented the invisible hand. He didn't call it that, but in the fable of the bees, he said, vice is virtue. Don't worry about it. Vice is what leads to the energy, the motivation, the incentives to make a really well-functioning hive. And so his idea of bees in the fable of the bees is that they're all lacking virtue. We now know biologically it's almost exactly the opposite, because bees are the quintessential eusocial species for ecologists and biologists. But for Mandeville, who had a huge influence, of course, on Smith, including, said in the fable of the bees, thus every part was full of vice, yet the whole mass of paradise, he's talking about the bees in the hive. And then he says, flattered in peace and feared in wars, they were the esteem of foreigners. And this became a scandal at the beginning of the 18th century. The scandal was that, basically the scandal of the invisible hand, which is, don't really worry about morality, because if you follow your self-interest, you'll end up with a highly productive society. Hume magnified the damage. What a genius, and how wrong on so many crucial points. Incredible genius. But really, on these issues, he did great damage. Hume's basic point was there cannot be moral science, because ought, which is what morality is about, cannot be derived from is. I think that that's just wrong. Is of a prisoner's dilemma can define what ought is in a very clear way, which is be pro-social. Then you can ask the question, how do you achieve that? But if you define moral science as a science of human well-being, there's no reason why that isn't a science of is. The ought in it is a definition of behaviors or principles or dispositions or virtues to get pro-social outcomes. And you might ask how you do that. But the value of doing so is an is, not an ought. But Hume said three very strange things, in my view, which have had a big impact. First, he said, reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions and can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them. What he means is, in the age-old debate, should reason serve the passions or should the passions be tamed by reason? With almost all philosophy beforehand saying reason needs to tame the emotions, Hume said, no, reason can never be a source of action. Only the passions can be a source of action. And reason is a slave of the passions. And this is an idea which is popular in some circles, that reason is only an ex post rationalization of what we do. We're motivated by deep unconscious forces, and we then give explanations for our behavior, but they're not really reasonable explanations or true reason. But then he said, the next line, tis not contrary to reason to prefer the destruction of the whole world to the scratching of my finger. Tis not contrary to reason for me to choose my total ruin to prevent the least uneasiness of an Indian or person wholly unknown to me. He is saying there is no sense of value judgments. You can say, I care about my finger, even if the implication would be that the whole world is destroyed. I would say that's not reason. That's insanity. That is not morality, and it is not how we would choose to behave, and that we can distinguish between David Hume's finger and the survival of the world. But the claim is we can't. And you saw some of that in Lionel Robbins' text also. We're indifferent to the ends. That's where it comes from. We're indifferent to the ends. They're arbitrary. They're just value judgments. They're not the is. They're just somebody's idea of the ought. Finally, he says, morals excite passions and produce or prevent actions. Reason of itself is utterly impotent in this particular. The rules of morality, therefore, are not conclusions of our reason. So that I strongly want to argue against. I want to argue that the prisoner's dilemma or a thousand variants like that give us cause for reason to say morality means something about human well-being. It's not arbitrary. We care about the flourishing. Adam Smith, of course, had many variants, but his great book on the theory of moral sentiments was, while he was an admirer and contemporary of Hume, and in some ways had an overlap, Smith did talk about where moral feelings come from, and he put a lot of emphasis on reputation and the social context as being able to enforce positive or moral pro-social outcomes, except for the rich, he said, something I'm going to talk about tomorrow. He said, it's only the average people, they're moral in their behavior. They care about their reputation to others. Rich people, they're immoral. And so it's a wonderful sociology. But Smith talked about what does moral sentiment mean, and he says it's thinking of an independent spectator who is judging you. And he said, we have that capacity to think about the impartial spectator. And I can ask, would my act pass the test of an impartial spectator, whether it's the question of cooperation or whether it's the question of that transfer payment from a rich person to a poor person? How would an impartial spectator think? That's like Rawls's veil of ignorance that I talked about, or having to make judgments about transfers before you know whether you're individual one or individual two. Immanuel Kant, of course, put the golden rule on a secular basis as a matter of duty. And he invoked what he called the categorical imperative. And the categorical imperative, in one of its famous instantiations, is act only according to that maxim whereby you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. If you will that cheating is a universal law, you end up in the antisocial corner of the matrix. If you will that good behavior is a universal principle, you end up with the pro-social outcome. Kant uses that argument to say lying is bad, cheating is bad, and that those cannot be condoned by as a categorical imperative. He said, and this is also important for us, morality is not the doctrine of how we may make ourselves happy, but how we may make ourselves worthy of happiness. And for Kant, happiness is not the issue. Duty is the issue. This is deontological moral theory. This is the responsibility. For Aristotle, mind you, it's not duty. It's the dispositions to behave in a certain way. For Aristotle, a moral person living a virtuous life doesn't cheat and doesn't embezzle and is altruistic. And how? Because they've learned it. They've studied it. They've been following a mentor. They've practiced it over the years until it becomes an internal disposition. It's not a battle. For Kant, it's duty. I don't like it. It hurts. I'd rather cheat, but I understand the categorical imperative. This is very important in moral thinking, the difference of duty or deontological versus disposition, which is an internal feeling. But the internal feeling is very important because all theories about cultivation of the individual is about how to cultivate dispositions of moral behavior. We don't talk about that in economics at all. In fact, I'll get to that in a moment. Jeremy Bentham, Richard Layard's hero, and a good guy, said that, of course, that the said truth is the greatest happiness of the greatest number is our measure of right and wrong. I would say I'm following a similar logic here, that what moral science is about is to produce pro-social outcomes. That's what morality means. Of course, there are issues about the distribution. Do we look at averages? Are we maximizing in some sense, or what is it that we're maximizing? But it is the same idea that what moral science is the science of well-being at population scale, and what is conducive to that, and how to create the rules, the maxims, the dispositions for that kind of outcome. Now, all of this took a huge step forward when we finally started to get a scientific theory of human nature. And I would say Aristotle's great insight 2,300 years ago is that man is a social animal, but he couldn't know why. And in fact, we could not really understand why until we had the evolution of our species and the ability to study the evolution of behavior as part of our empirical base. And so it was only in 1859 with The Origin of Species and in 1871 with The Descent of Man with Darwin that we began to have an anthropology that is based on a deep understanding of human nature. And Darwin says, with all his noble qualities, with sympathy which feels for the most debased, with benevolence which extends not only to other men, but to the humblest living creature, with his godlike intellect. By the way, that doesn't sound like Hobbes. Noble qualities, sympathy which feels for the most debased, benevolence which extends not only to other men, but to the humblest living creature, with his godlike intellect which has penetrated into the movements and constitution of the solar system. With all these exalted powers, man still bears in his bodily frame the indelible stamp of his lowly origin. And what Darwin put forward here is how moral traits, moral dispositions, moral instincts could develop as part of natural selection. And I'm going to talk about that tomorrow because the most current theories of natural selection give us a kind of split human nature with incredible capacities to do good and incredible capacities to do evil. And that the sages knew very well, but now we have a much better understanding from natural selection and from deep human nature of why that might be. Ronald Coase, I want to add, because when we get back to the market, he says, well, there's another approach, and that's property rights. If you really want to be in the pro-social outcome, I don't know about morality, but why don't you guys sign a contract? And it's enforceable. It's a good idea, by the way. That's why we have contract law. We don't have to just trust the other person, but we know that contracting, also from Coase, is expensive. Transactions costs are high, and if we had to contract every time we do a polite thing to another person, we would spend all our time with lawyers, which we do anyway. Albert Tucker, 1951, The Prisoner's Dilemma, putting this on a sound idea of what is pro-social, what is antisocial, rigorous for the first time, being able to distinguish human behavior, that it may be moral and not, because now we have a definition of the good, a clear, unambiguous definition. It's the pro-social outcome. And then you can ask, do people actually behave that way? How could you make them behave that way? How could you increase the frequency that behave that way? That's moral science. And so the clarity that has come with game theory, in my view, is extremely important. Of course, the idea of one kind of behavior as being very robust and powerful is due to Anatole Rapoport, the idea of tit-for-tat or forgiving tit-for-tat strategy, which is like a golden rule in a way, except a golden rule with the ability to move. He said, in the simplest terms, cooperate on move one, thereafter do whatever the other player did the previous move. So if you were playing someone else and you both cooperate again. They cooperated. Cooperate again. If they cheat, then you cheat. That's the tit-for-tat strategy. Unfortunately, in the pure version of that strategy, if one side cheats by accident or malevolently, you never get out of it. And so from time onward, everybody cheats. I've often wondered whether Russia's a little bit like that, actually, because really the pervasiveness of cheating and lying is a social characteristic that differs across countries. That's not my view. That's the results of comparing studies across countries, which have very different outcomes systematically on prisoners' dilemma games, for example. And so the question where those historical differences come from is something I'm going to talk about tomorrow. And this leads to the idea of how might we have evolved. One way we might have evolved is what's called conditional cooperation. We'll start out being nice, and as long as we stay nice, we'll continue to stay nice. I feel that that is not only a plausible strategy, but I feel that internally, that is a reasonable representation. Donald Trump has a different idea, tat for tit or whatever it is, without going into more. He says, okay, first I'm going to slug you in the face, and then we're going to sit down and talk. And that's the idea that there are killers and losers, and you have to know who I am. That doesn't lead to very good outcomes in general. That leads to war and to antisocial outcomes. We're trying to educate our president quickly on that point. Apparently China has made some headway last week. Now, a couple of other quick points. We've learned the next addition to human nature is the breakthroughs in neuroscience of the last 50 years. One of the most important breakthroughs is neuroplasticity. And this is an obvious point in a way, but we know we change in our lives. We change biologically. We form new neurons, new synapses. We lose old synapses. And so our experience molds us. That is the idea of Aristotle or Confucius. But now we have a neurobiological basis for understanding this. We also have a neurobiological basis for understanding how neuroplasticity causes addictions, causes many kinds of, can contribute to many kinds of adverse outcomes. But Mesernick says your brain, every brain, is a work in progress. It is plastic. From the day we're born to the day we die, it continuously revises and remodels, improving or slowly declining as a function of how we use it. That's important for moral science. The idea that tastes are given, which you learn in the first week of microeconomics, is wrong. Demonstrably, scientifically, utterly wrong. Tastes are the result of life, of experience. And part of tastes, like the interests in cooperation or not, which is part of those tastes so-called, are molded by history, molded by practice, molded by habit. And Ed Wilson, the great founder of sociobiology, taking a marvelous couple-page insight from Darwin's Descent of Man in 1871, where Darwin talks about two-level selection, that we learn to cooperate so our group is stronger, but groups then compete with other groups in war over turf. And so there's selection within groups and selection between groups, and that ends up molding a split human nature that has great capacities for altruism, but also great capacities for cruelty, but often based on whether the counterpart is an in-group counterpart or an other counterpart. And this is one of the most important insights of modern sociobiology. And finally, deep mind. Why deep mind? Because in the end, the robots are going to be doing all of this anyway. And so we are going to need a moral code in the literal sense. What is coded in the robots? What is coded in the artificial systems? And what we're learning, if you study moral science, one of the things you study endlessly these years is the so-called trolley problem. I thought it was ridiculous how much time moral theory has spent on the trolley problem. I'll discuss it a little bit tomorrow. But now we actually have autonomous trolleys, so they're going to have to solve the trolley problem. I realized finally it wasn't just a heuristic, it was literal coding that we need. So I just want to add that this is one more element that is going to come in. So I gave you 18 steps of the last 2,500 years, but I want to say what is the cul-de-sac of modern economics. What you learn is people have tastes. They maximize those tastes. The gustibus non est disputatum. Don't argue with the tastes. Don't compare tastes. Ends are not to be discussed. They are to be maximized. That's where Robbins started. Where did economics get to this? It started with Hobbes, that there is no social order. And then a more recent philosopher, Margaret Thatcher, said, there's no society, they're just individuals. That's a Hobbesian idea. It is demonstrably false from an evolutionary psychology point of view, a social psychology point of view, a behavioral point of view, but it is part of British political and moral philosophy, and it is a damage, actually. Second is there is no, that there's virtue from vice. Why are you worrying about this? Now, this is an empirical question. How important are those social dilemmas? Because in general equilibrium theory, in Aero-Debreu models, they don't exist. You have complete markets. You have perfect competition, and so you don't have social dilemmas. But I would argue empirically, and this is what economic science should be better at doing, they're pervasive, I would say. They're everywhere. That's why we discovered that social capital really affects economic performance. It really affects well-being, because they're pervasive, those social dilemmas. So you don't get virtue from vice. Yes, there's an invisible hand, but it can really swat you around, cause a lot of damage. No ought from is. I was taught that. It's wrong, in my opinion, because the is of moral science is human betterment. And that, I believe, can be defined as an is. What makes people happier, healthier, more satisfied with their lives, and how do you achieve it? That's getting an is from an is. The ought part says, what are the better outcomes that a society can aim for, and how might they be cultivated, which is what traditional moral theory was about. Bentham, that it's about pain and pleasure. We know that this is a big oversimplification, but it turned by Jevons and Edgeworth into a utility function. And then it turned into a preference ordering. Stable, not to be explained, and generally individualistic methodologically. Not anything like human nature. And then, as I said, de gustibus non est disputandum. That doesn't allow for plasticity, for cultivation of dispositions, and there's no end, there's no purpose, there's just maximization. And if that's all the science is, it's not surprising that millions of people are left to die or that we're not able to handle the climate crisis, because there is no end, no difference. The end of maximizing Donald Trump's income is the same as saving the planet. What's the difference? That's what we were told. It's just a maximization problem. But if economics is no more than that, economics is useless or more than dangerous. So we need a new moral science that's based on the science of human nature, which we find from evolutionary theory, psychology, and neuroscience. We need systems dynamics of game theory, institutional behavior, and now artificial systems and coding. And we need a telos, what Aristotle called the end, but an end for a purpose. Not an end where every end is like every other, but the end of human well-being. And we know a lot about human thriving. We know that there are physical and there are social needs that are base needs. People cannot survive as solitary individuals, not as healthy individuals. As Aristotle said, they're either a god or an animal, he said, people that try to live alone. There are physical needs and physical yearnings, food, sex, water. And then there are the issues of meaning, the purposes in life, the excellences of achievement, and the spiritual views. We all die. What do we make of that for our meaning of life? What does that imply for human well-being, for what we give to our children, what we give to society, what we hope to accomplish in that view? And these needs and meanings are the result of both nature and cultivation. They don't just come by themselves. We are growing individuals. Our lives are lives where our choices affect the future, and we need mentoring, knowledge, experience, cultivation in order to get this very complicated part right. So I know I'm late for time, and I'll keep you 5 more minutes over. Let me say a word then summarizing about the place of morality within society. Human well-being is promoted by a moral code that defines pro-sociality. That's an is from an is. We can define what leads to better outcomes for humanity. Moral behavior is promoted in three ways: by duty, deontological, by reputation, as in Smith, and by virtue, meaning cultivating the dispositions of good behavior. Virtues are the transformation of duties and codes into internal dispositions. There are virtues of self-control, which I'm not going to talk about very much, but how to achieve a flourishing of the self. And there are virtues of social management, which I did talk about. The moral code has to evolve according to changing technologies, because as technology changes, as we go from rural to urban, for example, what is pro-social and anti-social is going to change. What are public goods are going to change. And so the moral code has to evolve. But the basic idea of a code that leads to human betterment doesn't change. That remains a fundamental point. It's just what is really pro-social will change over time depending on technological change. And then the place of morality within economics. Economics is not the maximization of scarce resources for any ends, in my view. It's for a particular end, which is human well-being. That's what economics should be about. And so it has to incorporate human well-being as a core part of our discipline. In other words, you can't do economics, in my view, without having a serious viewpoint and a science-based viewpoint about human well-being. It's like saying, I'm going to medical school, but I'm indifferent whether it's disease or health. Get out of there. Don't go to economics if you're indifferent about the ends, because we're useless otherwise. Worse than useless, dangerous. We take up space of people that should be solving problems for well-being. So the goal, in my view, is eudaimonia, human thriving. And the objectives of economics should therefore include understanding the sources of human flourishing, identifying social dilemmas, promoting pro-sociality, promoting moral behavior, and cultivating virtue. In other words, all of those are part of economic science. And Danny Kahneman, I don't have time to, I'll come pick this up tomorrow. Yes, we know from behavioral economics it's not so easy, because our cognitive control is, like Darwin said, it was made in the savanna or in the arboreal ecology millions of years ago. We make mistakes. We need to understand our human nature. I believe it's not that the passions drive the reason, as Hume said, but the opposite, that we need to use reason now to understand our mental makeup, especially the reason of evolutionary psychology, social psychology, and neuroscience to do it. And finally, I want to say that we now know a lot about observed well-being. And thanks to Richard and John Helliwell, we have a tremendous empirical base in the last 25 years of why countries differ in their reported average reports of well-being. And we know that those categories of needs, both biological and social, as well as purpose, all play important roles. So income matters, of course, because that helps to meet needs. Health matters as a basic biological urge. Holding pro-social values, cultivating one's own values, helps to live a life that's meaningful, and a life that's meaningful is a life that is also a thriving life. Social trust is extremely important, especially if you're in a world of conditional cooperators. Low social trust means everybody cheats and says to each other, of course everybody cheats. That's what Wall Street's like. That is literally what Wall Street's like right now. They cheat, and when they get caught, they say, my counterpart's a big boy, they should know I'm going to cheat on them. It's like worse than kindergarten. But it brought down the world economy in 2008. I'll come back to it tomorrow. Political trust is important because, as Aristotle said, politics is not just a game of power. It is how we express our social needs. Or at least it should be, and it can be. And finally, capabilities, the freedom to make life choices, matter a lot. These are all measurable, demonstrable, and they explain a tremendous amount of the differences across countries. Our job as economists are to help our societies to achieve a higher level of well-being. I'll talk about some of the problems with that tomorrow. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. That was a real tour de force. Now, we have run over time. I'm aware of that. But we do have a little bit of time for some questions. So if you'd like to put up your hand. Have we got mics? Yes, we've got mics. There's a gentleman there. Could we go to that gentleman?
Hi, Professor Sachs. Oh, first of all, thank you for the lecture. It's been really, really enlightening. My first question was about how to reconciliate between different morality from different culture, but I assume that is the topic tomorrow, so I may just skip that one. But my second question is actually about this absence of equity in the lecture today. I understand with all the philosophical concepts, equity is probably inevitable.
Apathy.
Equity.
Equality.
Equity,
sorry, yes.
Yeah, but I'm just concerned why the actual word equality or equity has never featured even once in the lecture. And do you actually believe that with all the moral values in mind, we can automatically reach equality? Or do you think that maybe equality is not as important as a value as the others that you've mentioned? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think if I could give a quick answer to both, I believe that there are very important common features of human nature which lead us to commonalities of moral reasoning. There are certain ideas like the Golden Rule and charity for the poor, which are universal across Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Confucianism, and other major religions. And I think that's not an accident. These are common features of a common reality. But of course, the specifics have a big difference, and history makes a very big difference, and actual outcomes and behaviors are very different. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about the problem of multiple equilibria. Because of conditional cooperation, you can get stuck in a very bad social outcome. And many societies are low trust, immoral societies where there's a tremendous amount of law breaking, but that's taken as given. Those societies suffer, would be my main point, the consequences of that. That's not just a casual observation, that's a matter that should be a very high concern for those countries. With regard to equity, that's what I mean by distributive justice. But the word could have been there. I will say more about it in the next 2 days.
Okay. I'm going to try and collect up three questions now so that we can do that.
Hi there.
Yes.
Oh, I'm on. Good. Anissa Wachuko, I'm a sustainable development consultant.
Sorry, wave your hand. Yeah.
Hi. It strikes me, having been at Columbia in the PhD program, that at some level, in a field that often thinks of science as its religion, that technical rigor, to some extent, has crowded out ethical rigor. And I want to know, from your perspective, how can we create the space for stewards like yourself of the discipline of economics throughout the generations? How do we create additional space where the discipline can value ethical rigor as much as it values technical rigor and place as much emphasis in training the next generation of economists in that way.
Thank you, sir. And then, yeah.
Hello. My name is Oded from the World Federalist Movement, and I would like to know about the 6 million kids that die each year. The reason you asked, you raised the question of why do they die and why don't we do anything about it. The reason that I'm not harming other people is the combination of three factors: morality, norms, and laws. And the difference between when I'm looking at reality, so I see that people are not harming their citizens as they do to non-citizens. And the 6 million kids that die in the third world, the difference between me and them is not that we have different morality, but that we have different sets of laws. That there are laws here that protect me, but those laws do not apply to them, so it's easier for me to harm them. And so I think that while morality is incredibly important, I think that the most important explanation for the death and for the lack of all those things is the lack of common law for humanity. While there is common economy and common market, our economy is integrated globally, while our politics are divided. And therefore, I think, and I would like to hear your opinion, I think that the most important call of people of morality today is to say that we should unite our political system and overcome the global apartheid that we have in a nation-state division that we currently have, and set up a global federation.
Thank you. Could we just try and keep the questions a bit briefer? Would help.
But that was great.
Thank you very much for the talk.
Where?
Far right.
Yes. Hi.
I'm a student of African development, so I have two very brief questions for you. The first is responding to the malaria that you mentioned early on, that it would be very easy to kind of continue to get to the point of zero malaria in the world through perhaps distribution of bed nets. But I think that the issue is not so much at the moral level, but at the tangible level. So looking at Dambisa Moyo and Dead Aid, compared to maybe your perspective, I think that you both agree that you want to end malaria, but have a different approach for tackling that goal. So I guess I would like to hear tangibly, perhaps for the malaria issue, you know, what is the best approach in your opinion? Is it that we continue to, I don't know, distribute free nets, or that we perhaps create factories in Africa so they're making their own malaria nets? That was kind of long, so that's enough for me. Here's another.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. We've got time for one more question, so we'll allow your neighbor to do it. And because I'm afraid the hall is booked after this, so then we'll get Jeff's answers and then we'll have to finish. I'm sorry that I can't do any more.
I'll be quick. I just wanted to, Melda Salhub, strategy consultant, I wanted to know your thoughts on universal basic income, particularly given the theme of morality and the net job loss that's likely to happen as a result of AI and machine learning, et cetera.
Great. Thank you.
So let me be brief, especially since we're running out of time, and I'll touch on some of these issues later. The point about why the kids are dying and what to do about it, in my view, has two parts. One is there was almost no care about that issue at all 15 years ago. I know it because I started a lot of the campaign to do something about it. And the idea that everyone cared but people had different ideas is not true at all. Almost no one gives a damn till today. I don't hear 10 different ideas about how to save those 5.9 million lives. I hear almost none. Pope Francis has called it the globalization of indifference. They're blind to us, these deaths and this suffering. So this is not primarily a debate about means. And with all due respect to Dambisa Moyo, she wasn't campaigning for malaria control. She was answering me. And it was not that she had this great deep interest in an alternative. Now, factually, I will tell you that this is about extreme poverty. So it's not about where the nets are manufactured. It's about how very poor people can get them and how poor people in poor countries can get them. But I will tell you something important, which is that if people actually cared about this issue, they would study it enough to know that, because the casual responses are responses of ignorance in general. People do not understand budgets of these countries. They do not understand household incomes of extremely poor people. They make up all sorts of ideas. Well, if they wanted nets, they should buy nets. They should get nets. It's not just nets, by the way. It's a little bit more of a public health ecosystem, but it's beyond the reach. I was with the president of one of the world's poorest countries yesterday, and we have been trying to help that country for years to mobilize resources to have the most basic control. It's almost impossible. This world doesn't care. And the problem is not that they tell you three other good ways to do it. They tell you, Professor Sachs, we've already gone through the three-year aid cycle. I'm sorry, there's no resources. But it's a great cause you're doing. And I say, go to hell. You're responsible in the international system, and people are dying on your watch. And so we never even get to the factual arguments because there's so little attention to these issues. That's the real problem. If we ever got to the factual issues, we would solve the problem in no time. Because there are costs, you ask who can pay, how it can be done. It's not so complicated, actually. That's why I say when I finally, it took me 7 years to get the idea of a free distribution of bed nets. Then the deaths came down sharply, but no one came running to me to say, okay, now what do we do? Because they don't care. Because every step is a fight. It's not serious. And none of these objections has been serious. What Dambisa Moyo said in the end, which I find deeply objectionable, was she said, I'm interested in development, not Band-Aids. Well, hell, this isn't Band-Aids. And if a Band-Aid saves a kid's life, then I like Band-Aids. And that's also a casualness about these issues that I think comes back to the idea that we have lost the moral discourse. What's important? How do you know it's important? How do you discuss it, therefore? And it's so important that it gets our attention span to actually analyze these questions. Then I'd love for someone to come and do a better idea than I have. That I don't care about, as long as it gets done. But I care about the lack of focus. Kim Kardashian has 10 million times more attention than the kids dying of malaria. And that is our social problem. That is about our ethics. And that's in a deep sense, that we don't have the discourse to know what should our ends be, because we've lost that. And that's really the point I'm trying to make. Issues of basic income, I'll come back to that, but the idea is, on the third day, we could end extreme poverty without too much trouble. That is like a universal basic income. Of course, you can talk about this proposal in a UK or US context. You can talk about it as ending extreme poverty. But the idea that people should meet their basic needs because that's the first on the list of human well-being is a moral issue. And so, yes, the answer is, while there may be technically better or worse ways to help meet those basic needs, in a world economy that's $125 trillion, 1% would easily solve these problems of deaths, children not in school, people without access to safe water, people without access to basic nutrition. It's not even breaking a sweat if you have $1 trillion a year to do this. And that's obviously less than 1% of our global income. We just really don't care enough. How to create space for ethical training? The Robbins Lectures. See you tomorrow.